I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Whenever somebody changes their heart, whenever they wake up to the reality of the fact that there's this one big ocean and we're all waves made of that ocean, then compassion comes quite naturally. Altruistic motivation comes quite naturally.
Hi, everyone. It's Raghu back with Mind Rolling, and my guest today is Lama Tsomo. Lama, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Raghu. So happy to be here.
And we must thank our mutual friend, Duncan Trussell, for introducing us.
So, yeah.
And since he's my podcast guru, I namaste to him. Oh, boy. So, well, the very first thing is, can we just find out a little bit about you and how you came up in this world? And most importantly, why in the world did you gravitate towards, I mean, Lama is obviously in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And so how did you get there from a little guy to where you are now?
Well, as a little gal, when I was about to celebrate, I think it was my ninth birthday, I had a serious problem to solve. The night before my birthday, I was like, okay, I have one wish when I blow out the candles. What's that wish going to be? And I really considered this long and hard because I'd read fairy tales. And in a lot of the fairy tales, they had three wishes and they still screwed it up. So I thought, okay, I've only got one wish. I'm probably going to screw it up. So I better really think about this. So I thought, well, you know, I'd wish for this, but then I thought, well, but that could go wrong in this way. You know, this other thing could go wrong in some other way. And so I thought, well, what is loophole free here? And so then I decided, actually, my bottom line is I want to be happy. So no matter what happens, if I'm happy, I'm good with that. So that was my wish. And really? Ever since then, that's been, you know, pretty much that was my wish all the way until now. I more specifically wish for enlightenment. But that comes to the same thing in my mind.
Gee, and so Barbie dolls? Yeah. What happened to Barbie dolls? Come on.
I wasn't into dolls.
No?
No. I was actually president of the Tomboy Club.
Oh, yeah.
In kindergarten. Yes. Yeah.
So, but what are the, you know, say advance a little bit teenagehood, what are the things yeah. that made you realize that there was a path potentially to be happy?
Yeah, so I was fascinated by psychology in high school. And like on a camping trip, I remember being perched in a tree and reading a book on Freud. And shortly after that, 15.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, go figure. Nobody said I was normal. Anyway, then shortly after that, I was reading Jung, and that felt more on track for me, and I really appreciated that. Basically, I was on track for figuring out how could I be a better, happier person. And I wanted to help other people be better, happier people. That seemed, you know, like the best thing to do. So you can see the logical progression from 9 to 15 to after that. Yeah, so I was looking for the methods. I figure I want to know, how do you do this? And I started with the best of the West, and then gravitated to Eastern methods. Well, so that's just a really quick recap.
Yeah, but who in who was that? I mean, to me, there's always some catalyst, a person who represents a catalyst to moving into living your dharma, living within what it is that you're supposed to be doing in this life. Who was that for you?
Well, let me start by sort of the approach till I actually met that person.
Okay, right? Good.
Yeah. So, you know, early in my adult years, I realized meditation would be a good thing. But I was living in the country, homesteading, and there was nobody to really take meditation from. And so I was just kind of sitting on the couch for 15 minutes a day, you know, between when my kids went to sleep and I was falling asleep. And didn't feel like I was getting very far, and then got discouraged and sort of gave up on it. And then I discovered after 5 years of not doing it, I realized what the benefit was, because I kept coming to myself when I would sit with myself and turn the lens inward instead of always outward and reacting to outer things. And so I could hear that still small voice. I could notice what was true for me and come back to myself again and again. And so then going through my day, all the thousands of decisions we make, all those little decisions that actually make up our path through life, I was more on track. And so when I stopped, I realized after 5 years, wow, I'm off track. And so I actually need to learn how to meditate. But just like you go to a piano teacher when you want to learn how to play piano, I'm going to go to a meditation teacher and learn how to meditate. So I sounded this note in the universe every day at meditation time, you know, kind of calling my teacher. And I didn't really care what brand they were, you know, Taoist, Zen. I didn't really care. The main thing, you know, I actually made a list so I could be really clear in my mind. You know, must not want me for my body, must be well-educated. And, you know, I had the pros and cons all listed out. And so then I started meeting lamas and various and Zen teachers and so on. I was,
in the West though, not
in the West. Yeah. So I was living in Boulder, Colorado by that time. And so it was kind of a great smorgasbord to meet lots of teachers. Right. And Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein came and did a meditation retreat. And that was my first instruction in meditation.
Couldn't be better, so, as far as I'm concerned.
That's absolutely right. I was so lucky. And from there, I progressed to Zen, because that didn't feel quite it. So then I went to Zen, and that was good, but that still didn't hit the spot for me. And then a friend who lived nearby brought in an American Lama who talked about Tibetan Buddhism. And the more he talked, the more it made sense to me. And it
who
just was clicking for me. Yeah, Tuku Yeshe Nima was his name. He's no longer alive. He was a student of Jalcho Rinpoche. And he brought over Tuku Sangak Rinpoche. We'll get to him in a minute. So I started doing the Lundro, which is the preliminary practices. And that's a set of five practices that are foundational in Tibetan Buddhism. And I was loving it. So I decided I'm going to try a retreat because, you know, intensive learning, if you want to change your brain, you know, seems like a good idea. So I went.
You had children when this was going on?
Yes, but one silver lining to divorce is that sometimes they're with their dad.
Oh, perfect. Right.
Yeah. So I went while they were with their dad. I went to his center and was able to do a 10-day retreat working on the Ngundro. Well, the next part of the Ngundro that I was due to practice was just coming up. And this Lama pops into this center in like rural New Mexico outside of Santa Fe and is teaching the same practice that I was about to do in my next stage of the Ngundro. And at that time, I did not get that he was my Lama. But the next time I saw him was at my house. Oh. So yeah, Tupu Yeshe Nima no longer had a center. He needed teachings, and he asked if I would host him and this Lama, Tupu Sangha Rinpoche. Mm. And so I said, sure. And so the next time I meet him, he's on my doorstep. And, you know, he's staying for 10 days in my house giving teachings. So I was able to sit in on the teachings. And a few days into it, I realized, oh, this is my teacher. This is my Lama. Mm. It was a little slow. So that's how I discovered how I came upon my teacher.
Wow. Is he still alive?
He is.
Wow.
Yeah.
And lives in India, I'm supposing?
No, actually, he spends a lot of time in India, but in America, he lives in Santa Fe, actually.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
He was living in Montana for a while with his family and then moved to Santa Fe, but still spends time in Montana. Mm-hmm.
So finally, you had a rudder, so to speak, that you totally trusted. And, you know, many people write to us and ask about, well, how do I find my guru? Interchangeable with, an enlightened teacher. And I, when I say enlightened, by the way, I have no idea. I met that being, which I wouldn't be qualified to know anything about the depth of which was beyond me, except for the fact that I was shocked by the fact that I knew there was not a polarized thing going on in this human being. There was no I and you. There was nothing like that going on. So it was more like a computer, kind of, is what my experience was at the time. So we get asked this question a lot. And of course we say, this will come to you as long as you have intention that is right intention. That's part of the Eightfold Path.
That seems to be what happened. That's exactly what happened. That's well said. I wanted the two purposes. I wanted happiness and enlightenment for myself and for others. And I wanted to help others to do that. And, you know, I wasn't in particularly great shape to do that at the time. Need a little work. So, then I wrote that list and, got my lens very clear. Because I figured, you know, then if I sound the note, the note is clear, and also my lens in being able to see when that the right person came along would be clear.
Yeah.
And I did forget one thing on the list. He was everything on the list that I wanted and none of the things that I didn't want. But I forgot to write, must speak English.
Oh.
Yeah.
And
yeah, he only speaks Tibetan.
Yeah. Well, most of them do have a translator, but not while they're just hanging at your house, I guess.
He didn't have a translator. He was very new to the West at that point, and nobody knew about him. And, you know, that took a while. But it just so happened that the person I think is really the best Tibetan English translator in the world happened to have a free space in his schedule at that time. So he came and translated. It was amazing.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I've always thought of His Holiness, his translator, Jinpa. As marvelous.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. And what a wonderful human being.
Yeah. Incredible.
Chuki Nima, also known as Richard Barron, is, I think, a fantastic translator. So
Chuki Nima, that's one of Tulku Urgen's sons. So different Chuki Nima, right?
Different Chuki Nima. This fellow was born in Canada.
Oh, boy. So when Duncan introduced you to me by just saying, you know, I did this wonderful podcast, I then searched you. And one of the things that came up is immediately was this talk that you gave. We've discussed this offline. And in that talk, you started the talk. It just blew my mind. The whole talk started with, now, we do every day, we are going through the movie of me. And those, you know, exact words. And I was like, oh, Jesus, I have been working on that with Duncan for years, talking about it on podcasts. And we're still working on a movie of me to the movie of we, basically, is the
that's great.
It's what you're doing. It's what you did in that.
Yeah.
And so I was then blown away, of course, by the synchronicity of it. Mm-hmm. But let us, and I have to give credit where credit's due. My friend Krishnadas, the chant guy, he in his talks and hangouts brings this up a lot. We wake up in the morning and you are with the movie of me, and it's 24/7, goes on and on. And it's, you're the protagonist, you're the writer, you're the director, you're the producer.
Exactly, I talk the same way. I know.
I know. So when I heard that, I was like, Jesus. And I know, I don't even know if you know who Krishnadas is, actually.
I know who he is. I've never heard him speak.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you more chance than he does give workshops and so on, and he does speak. But anyhow, it was so exactly the same. It just was really, oh boy.
Let's unpack that a little bit more.
Yeah, that's what I want you to do.
All right, because what occurred to me when I thought about that was a couple of things. First of all, we don't realize that we're the author, right? That we're writing
completely
the movie.
Not. Yeah. It's
how
real.
Good is that how good is that movie going to be then?
Yeah.
We don't even know we're writing it. Okay. Yeah. That's not promising.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And then another thing that I realized was if you look at how a movie works, right? It's one frame after another frame after another frame. And it's actually nothing in between. So it's a frame, nothing, frame, nothing, and so on and so forth. And our minds string them together into this whole, movie. We aren't seeing frame, emptiness, frame, emptiness, frame, emptiness. We aren't seeing the change from frame to frame. We're just seeing the movie. We're totally caught up in what's going on in the movie, you know, the drama of it. So that's another thing I realized. And I wrote about it in the first book of my series.
Hmm. Let's elaborate a little bit more about the space in between, because one great teacher who we loved and I still refer to, of course, Trungpa Rinpoche, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, and how he used to talk about the gap in meditation between thoughts and so on. And
Mind the gap.
Yeah, mind the gap, right, that bill. But the reality of what you're just saying, the frame to frame to frame to frame, and it's on automatic, it's driven by neurotic tendencies and habitual patterns and belief in thoughts and who you think you are, identity and role. The whole, Ram Dass is good at talking about just that kind of thing. You must have actually appreciated him a little bit because of him being into psychology and being able to express it in that way. But, so I think at one point, what did you say that caught me? Well, first of all, it seems to be a way to support our theory, non-theory, belief in a reality that we are a separate entity. And no matter, even intellectually, you get on the path, you intellectually know differently, supposedly, but the belief is so strong that this movie, frame to frame to frame, that gap just doesn't exist. We don't allow it to be. If you want, can you talk a little bit about how investigating the gap, shall we say, can make mm-hmm. a big difference in terms of turning that movie into a non-reality? This is not who you are.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to turn to physics for a second.
Okay.
David Bohm was a great physicist who talked about the universe as a moving hologram. He called it a holo movement. And he said it's as though it it flashes forth and then kind of goes back into pre-form, you know, so manifestation, emptiness, manifestation, emptiness. And he wasn't Buddhist, but he was speaking in those terms. Mm. I think that's so interesting. And there is a direct parallel here with the dying process. It's just happening way faster when we're talking about frame, emptiness. So we've in Tibetan Buddhism, they really delineated all of the stages of moving from incarnation in a body to the various stages of leaving the body and then being in between lifetimes. Mm-hmm. Bardo means Bardo. Literally in between. Mm. And then the Bardo of becoming. So there's this whole process then of landing in another body. So those stages happen instantly in between, you know, when you're finishing one frame and going into emptiness. So it's just a faster version.
Hmm. Yeah.
So of course we're terrified of death and we're terrified of that gap because the last thing in the world we want to let go of is our ego because we think we're that. And so we're afraid we'll lose ourselves entirely. Mm-hmm. That's, yep. I think, the essence of our fear of death and our fear of emptiness.
Mm, yeah. I saw, so Lama has a book coming out. It'll be out at the end of the summer, I think, early fall, something like that, of 2022. Mm-hmm. So not that far after you hear this podcast. And in the, what's the name of the book? Let's start there.
Deepening Wisdom, Deepening Connection, and because it's the third in the series.
Yeah.
The series is Ancient Wisdom for Our Times. Okay. And so in this third book, we deepen in the practices that we can use to become more wise and more compassionate and more feeling more deeply and vastly connected to all.
So in you mention Bohm in the book, and it seems, you know, he's not a Buddhist, he's not a this or that, but he seems to have a good sense of reality, shall we say, huh? And
yeah,
and he said that we can find our way out of this mess we've stumbled into, and it just starts with one person cleaning up their act when it comes to perceiving reality. Which is no more, I mean, I refer, I guess, a lot to Ram Dass because of my long term, and he had a great way of words to help people really understand the path. But certainly his thing was just nothing can happen for yourself or for anybody else on this planet until you change your heart, change your perspective. That's why at the end of his life, his main thing was getting out of your head and believing the story and the thoughts and into the center of your being, which we have so many different names for it, but spiritual heart is a good one. And then suddenly that perspective really helps to change a lot in one's own life, and then you can see it around you with people. So so I was taken by what he, that which you just explained. It was really cool.
I think too that what Bohm was getting at was since we actually are all from the same root and we are all connected, and when I say we're from the same root or the same source, that's not a historical fact, because remember, we're appearing and disappearing every nanosecond or whatever. So that's a current fact, that we're connected. So, I think, if we really understand the truth of that, then whenever somebody changes their heart, whenever they wake up to the reality of the fact that there's this one big ocean and we're all waves made of that ocean, then compassion comes quite naturally. Altruistic motivation comes quite naturally. And by the way, that whole ocean is affected by what you're putting out all the time. And that was something that occurred to me in young adulthood when I was going through a really difficult time being afraid of dying. And I was really worried about it and this kind of thing. I thought, I'm putting out a lot of mental pollution right now. This is irresponsible of me. I've got to figure this out. Then the reverse is also true. Somebody putting out, really deep, strong love and compassion and care for our fellow waves, then, that's what they're putting out. And people pick up on that. One person kindles another, and those waves go out in the ocean, and we're all affected by that.
Can I also say that it's just like coming from where all of us have this movie going on at one time or another, and sometimes we don't buy into it as much as other times. And the intention, which is to clean up your act and then be able to be of some use to our fellow humans and not being caught in the belief that we are separate, but we're always going to fall down. I like to point this out, Lama, mm-hmm. because it happens with absolutely everyone. I mean, I met a few beings that's not happening. They're no longer polarized, so they're a different species almost because of the rarity of it. But it's okay. I like Jack Kornfield. He's my favorite thing that he says a lot in his talks. It's okay to be human. It's okay.
Yeah.
Just look at your body and the way things work and the mouth. You put stuff in it. He's got a whole thing. And, watch yourself having sex. That's really weird.
And I don't think I'll do that.
No. So, but he says, the okayness. And the okayness, actually, it's what I got actually from Ram Dass the very first time I met him. And most people, when they first encounter him, his honesty leads one to go, okay, I'm not crazy. I'm not a crazy ass piece of junk, which I've been calling myself all along because I see the horror of my selfish interest, et cetera, et cetera. So it's okay. So in this, spiritual bypass is a very real issue for many, if not most people. In the most subtle ways, it can happen as well, where you're just acting out from a place that you're not quite realizing is still has self-interest manipulation motivation going on. And then you realize it and, it's okay.
So, a downside to turning your lens inward and having it, polishing it and cleaning it off can be that we see where we're not there yet and we can see all sorts of flaws. However, if we're doing this, I think in the way the great masters intend, we look upon ourselves with love and compassion, right? We're also one of the waves on the ocean. And that's the way the practice of Tonglin, for example, is constructed, is that we start with ourselves, turn that lens on us, and actually do a very strong practice of compassion first for ourselves.
Yeah.
And then we step it out. Yeah. That's a basis from which we can actually genuinely step it out and out.
Yeah. Probably the most difficult thing for people, is it not strange to have compassion for themselves, for ourselves? Being able to send, that's why Tonglin, well, first tell what Tonglin is, because we want to make sure everybody understands what definition of that term.
So it's a compassion practice, because compassion isn't just a passing sentiment, it's a capacity. And as with anything else, the more we do it, the more we practice it, the more we increase our capacity for it. Tonglin is a Tibetan practice. It means sending and receiving. Yeah. And in the practice, you use your breath and visualization, because that's natural to us. But now we point it in this direction, where then it's a very embodied, felt sense and envisioned sense of compassion. So it realizes it, you might say.
On its own. Another thing, pointing Ram Dass's things out, but they're also relevant right in the moment here. He said at one point, we have this wonderful Words of Wisdom book. I don't think there's a podcast recently, after I found this by accidentally opening up the book, that I haven't said this, because I feel it's the most important thing for people to start, all of us to start realizing. And he said, I myself stand in need of the arms of my own kindness. Just if we could just start there, it's, you know, I love the simplicity of it. And you do talk about coming from that place in this book. So I love that.
Foundational.
Practicality and simplicity, you know, can be very encouraging.
Well, and I think as I've talked with various Tibetans and heard the Dalai Lama talk about this, and my own Lama, and as I said, many Tibetans. It seems that there's a cultural programming that we get as Westerners that's very judgmental. You know, it's like
that's
we
a wild
okay
understatement.
Yeah, you know, it's something I've noticed, and it. It doesn't, you know, some of it may be human, but I think some of it is cultural to us in the West.
Absolutely.
That is my sense. Yeah. And I'm speaking in general terms. Of course, there are going to be exceptions on both sides of that equation. But as a cultural trend, I think that's strongly the case. And that's been my experience with students. So this is a wonderful antidote to that, because it's real. You are experiencing something simple, as you point out, and real. And that's the basis from which you can move out toward, you know, genuine love and compassion for others.
So what happened to me is, when I found this quote, and then around the same time, somehow a picture appeared that I had forever, I guess, but didn't notice it in many years. And it was a picture of me when I was maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 years old. They were doing one of those photo shoots they used to do back in the day. You know, you're wearing an outfit. It was so weird. And I was looking off into the distance, kind of like, oh my God, what is this all about? Kind of a sad looking, which I was called a sad kid for my whole beginning part of my life. And I put it up on my altar. Actually, you know what I put it with? Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. I thought that would be perfect. Those of you who may not know, we'll put it in the show notes, because you got to be connected with Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. Talk about practicality. Yeah.
So my teacher was his right hand man for 14 years Shenzhen. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I can't. Yeah, we could do a whole. We'll have to do a whole other podcast just on Dilgo Khyentse and your teacher. Okay, we'll do that.
That'd be great.
But can I? I don't know where I got this. I might have got it from. I think I got it from the new book actually, and it's all around what I just read, that quote of wrapping oneself in the arms of our own kindness. As an antidote. So this was someone, and we've talked about him before offline, Mingjur Rinpoche, who I've had on a couple of times. And let me just read, it's very brief. Another Tibetan Lama, Mingjur Rinpoche, also couldn't imagine what his Western students were talking about on this subject, which was the subject was the way in which we judge ourselves, et cetera, and the way how little we think of ourselves. I would go on even beyond that. How we talk to ourselves is awful, awful. And so he was determined to find out what the hell this is all about. That's from me. Because he felt that without truly understanding this in his bones, he wouldn't be able to help those students connect with the Dharma. So he decided to cultivate a bad opinion of himself. Just think of this. First of all, this is the one of the first, if not the first, Lama that was, experiments were done on him being able to go into certain meditative states. And he would, like, in an instant, compassion, boom, he was there. You know, they were using all the fMRI stuff. Richie Davidson was doing it. So he decided to cultivate a bad opinion of himself. We do that without any problem, but this is not something so easy for him. First, he grilled some of his top Western students to find out exactly where the negative opinions came from and how they worked. Then I love this story. Every day in meditation and in between, he focused on his faults and shortcomings. He told himself that because of these, he was intrinsically worthless. He gave himself all kinds of similar negative messages. One day, he realized that he was feeling little love for himself. He felt rather depressed. Then he thought, yay, now I get it. Now I don't like myself either. How wonderful. This is a different perspective. Okay, this human, very different. Now that's compassion. Needless to say, he resumed his usual practices and came back to his usual joyful state. And anybody who wants to see, because I video all my podcasts, so you can see this extraordinary joyful awareness of this being. You say, so start with love and affection for yourself. Is that a great, thank you for putting that in there. I love that story.
I love the story too. And it was told to me by one of his top students, one of his close-in students. Yeah. And it so struck me that I just had to put it in the book. And by the way, will you read the rest of my book? I'll have to record you for the book on tape. Yeah. That was great. Thank you.
Thank you. So going back to the movie of me and getting to the movie of us, first we have to sort of examine what are the elements that really put us on automatic movie of me land, our studio. So one of the things you talk about in the book is karma and the habits of mind sending us, from one dream to the next, from waking to dream, and having little to say in the matter is what you say. And I love how you described how we just talked about it being in the West, it's definitely different. And we Americans are even more different because we are all about freedom, individual freedom. But here's what the quote is: freedom to be led around by the nose, by our habit motivating cravings and anxieties, rather than our deepest, truest motivations. Can you talk about that for a minute? Just how how that occurs, and then the remedies.
Oh yeah. So I'll talk about myself. I wake up in the morning, and because of just the top layer of habit, I'll start with. I'm in the habit of snuggling and petting my dogs. If I really meant it, that my absolute goal is enlightenment, I would immediately sit up and do the waking up meditation. But first I pet my dogs. And then I go, okay, now, you know, I've been gratified with this, you know, desire that I want, you know, so I'm led by desire, right, for that. Mm. And, you know, I sit up and I do my waking up meditation. And then I'm, you know, annoyed because my puppy will run off and I don't have a fence right now. So I'm going to have to go stumbling quickly to the door before she pees on the floor. And the other dog is hysterical to get out the door. She's just like literally making all these noises because she wants to get out. Yeah. She can't get down the stairs fast enough to get out the door. She's frustrated. And, you know, then I'm kind of annoyed and all this kind of stuff. So this is what's going on. This is, you know, how I start my day. And then I stumble out the door with the dogs and, oh, the puppy's so cute. And so I'm enjoying the cute, you know, so I'm led around by the nose by all of this, you know, desire, you know, aversion, all these things. And then I finally sit down to meditate. But there's been this whole drama going on before I even get to the point. Did I mention I drink, you know, my green tea sitting down, sort of coming to. Then I sit down and meditate. Okay. And luckily, the first thing you do in Tibetan meditation is the cleansing breaths, the 9 rounds of cleansing breaths, which help to sort of clean out some of that static from your nadis, your channels, so that you have at least a little better chance of the clouds parting and having some moments of really coming from a truer, deeper place. Mm. Does that give you a little bit of idea? But what I haven't talked about, so that's the surface stuff, but there's the layers underneath. So there is the karma that propelled me into this life, you know, deep habits of mind.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to bring up. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And so the deepest one is the habit of seeing myself as separate from all and everything else. So I'm already, you know, just from the point of view of the tip of the wave and forgetting about the ocean and forgetting that I'm also ocean, you know, expressing itself in this wave, as well as all the other waves. So that mistaken habit of seeing is so deeply ingrained from who knows how many lifetimes. If you believe that your awareness doesn't dissolve when your brain rots, then, you know, I think there's recycling when it comes to souls. I don't think, you know, it's just once around and then you're just hanging out and you never incarnate again. Yeah. That doesn't make any sense. So,
you know who said that, Lama? Exactly what you just said. Jimi Hendrix.
Ooh. What?
Jimi Hendrix said, I can't imagine there not being reincarnation. He might not have said exactly that word, but that's exactly what he meant. Because everybody would be all stuck in one place. What are they going to do?
Yeah, it would get more and more crowded somewhere.
Yeah,
right. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So, so we go around and around, and the Buddhists say it's like bees in a bottle. You know, sometimes they buzz up, sometimes down, here and there and around, but they never get out. And the purpose of, practicing the Buddhist path and all the great religions is to wake up so that you actually get out of that bottle and you're free in the true sense.
Yeah.
Not free to follow your habits of mind, but truly free of those habits of mind. Yeah.
But again, I keep coming back to this little thing, what you said. You know, I had my cute puppy there. I just wanted to play with my cute puppy, and then I had to have my cup of tea, and then I got to sitting practice.
Yeah.
But there's a way in which I have seen this in many people and in myself, that when you are coming at that disciplined part with any kind of I need to do this, or I am less than because I played with my puppy first. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a slippery slope.
Oh, that's right? Judgment. Yeah. And that's a big Western habit. And I think it's kind of a human habit. Yeah, but I think it's the judgment thing. You know, it's okay to see when you're off track. By the way, did you know that the original definition of the word sin in ancient Hebrew means missing the mark?
Well, of course, Jewish people are very forgiving.
Well, and so the point is, I'm just missing the mark. I'm not there yet. And as one lady said in the middle of an argument, she was Buddhist, her husband wasn't. And the husband said, well, why are you mad? You're a Buddhist. You can't be mad. And she said, I'm a Buddhist, not a Buddha.
That's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. So I realize I'm not a Buddha and I accept that. And I'm not passing judgment on myself as, I don't know, somehow intrinsically bad.
Yeah. Right perspective is what we need to have with that.
Yeah. And just jettison the judgment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not
easy.
Anything.
We are just doing that. That's one of the deepest habitual patterns of humans is that. So it's, I like what you also say, the accurate translation of dukkha, which is suffering, means something more like insufficiency or lack of real satisfaction. That's also interesting to me, huh? Amazing.
Yeah. Well, language guides our thought. So I think it's important to really look at that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for example, the Tibetan word for, what is normally translated as renunciation. And they keep saying you must have renunciation. Well, Namjung is what they say, and translators then translate it. You must have renunciation in order to truly follow the path. But what they mean is actually more like fed upness.
Yeah, not giving up all your clothes, your house, and eating, you know, nothing.
Yeah, right, yeah, wearing a hair shirt or whatever. Right. No, it's more about... you know, it's like, okay, I've been around buzzing in that bottle for long enough to know this is not a great place to hang out. I just am fed up with it. I'm disgusted with it. You know, I want to be free of it. That's what's meant there. Yeah. And, you know, I've had moments of that deep kind of fed upness that they're talking about. And it truly was transformative for me.
Mm. That's what it takes. I mean, I, as a 16, 17 year old, I was just I was just depressed all the time, and I could not understand why I felt like I was in this confined mental box, and there was no spaciousness whatsoever. And my famous story is one John Coltrane song later, live at a club when I was 16, how I snuck in, you know, I went out of that box for however long, and that changed my life, actually.
Beautiful.
You know, one other thing, and we're talking, getting to some anecdotes, we're also getting along here, we have to go on for a few hours, but we can't. Just the idea of original sin in Christianity, and for that matter, Judaism.
It's not in Judaism.
Well, exoteric, that's the way I got it. You were bad, you were a sinner, okay? I don't care what they call it, but I was reprimanded all the time, okay?
I understand. It's just the actual...
The philosophical thing might have been different.
It was right? St. Augustine,
Yeah, but the reality was quite the same. And I did a podcast recently with Matthew Fox, actually, and it was he has a new book, and it was all around the idea of original blessing, not sin,
yes.
And of course, Tibetan's original purity. I think that's important. It's a starting place for... the antidote to the movie of me is that we are primarily pure beings that have the right intention.
Yeah, I mean, the way I understood it as a young adult was, well, if everything is made of God, then so am I.
Yeah.
So
right.
Are we all?
All the good and all the bad.
The confusion is sort of the messy clothes, but the essence is still pure.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So it's like if you throw a bunch of dirt in water, the Tibetans talk about this, the water itself is still pure water. You know, you can let the dirt settle to the bottom,
yeah,
and you've still
yeah.
got pure water. Yeah. By the way, speaking yeah. of Matthew Fox, did you know that he and I wrote a book together and did a series of videos? We did this whole long interfaith dialogue. Yeah.
Really? Oh, yeah. Is that available?
Yeah.
Okay, everybody who's putting the show notes together here, please make sure that that's a link is available there. Also a link, of course, for your first couple of books and the new book, which they can pre-order and all of that.
Right, so The Lotus and the Rose is the name of the book with Matthew Fox.
Matthew. Wow.
And we have on our website, namchok.org, we have a whole bunch of the video footage.
Oh, wonderful.
Which is probably more fun than reading the book. The book is big, you know, because took like 15 hours, 16 hours of video footage and just did it verbatim.
He's wonderful. Ram Dass did some stuff with him quite some time ago, actually. And he's also close to Mirabai Starr, who's part of our family. I don't know if you know her, but...
met her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have to talk about one thing, because when we're getting to the anecdote about how to move to the reality of the we and not the separate me, I think talking about shamatha, that's probably a better way to pronounce it, it is something very important. Now, it may be... I may be incorrect saying it's a little more advanced in terms of a practice, but I think the understand not. You think not?
I think not. I think you can get to very advanced stages of shamatha, but you can start out with just very basic, simple shamatha.
Okay, then please, can you describe that?
So one very simple practice. Let me back up, though, and just say the purpose of shamatha is to help us to slow down our minds a little bit, be able to train our minds so that when we set it onto something, whatever it is, it can stay there. Right now, it's a squiggly little puppy. I don't know why I'm thinking of puppies. It happens to be on my mind. But it is like that. And, you know, you can't get a puppy to do a downstay for an hour right off the bat. And if you try, you're going to just have a really frustrated puppy, really frustrated owner, and everybody's going to hate training sessions. So not advisable. But the purpose of shamatha is to get your mind to be able to settle and do a downstay and focus on a particular thing so that whatever practice you do in the future, you can just stay with it. And by the way, it's great in life. You know, wouldn't we all love to be able to have our minds just focus and settle on something in a very relaxed and open way, not like I must concentrate, you know, not like that. And actually you won't succeed. You'll just be fighting with yourself. So one very, very simple sort of beginning shamatha practice is to use your mind, joining your mind with your breath. And so if you imagine that your mind, the seat of your mind is here, and this is just the thinking machine that runs your body. But, you know, whenever we say, I believe such and such, we don't say I am Tsomo. We say I am Tsomo, right? So if you imagine that this is sort of the where your mind is generally
the spiritual
located.
Heart. Yeah. So it's loving awareness is what Ram Dass used to call
it. Yeah. So your awareness, you're trying to train your mind, your awareness. And so... you can close your eyes for this.
Yeah, why don't you do a little thing here? That'd be great for us to have, actually.
Okay. So on the exhale, you send your mind and breath, they're joined together. You send them out together, just like I'm pointing with my finger, out and down, and rest for a moment. And then on the inhale, you bring your breath and your mind back in. And and then send it out again. Leaving it sitting out there. And in again. Sending it out again. And as it's sitting out there, utter stillness, savoring that stillness, and drawing it in. And one more time. Very gently out, resting, savoring, focusing only on this, and then drawing in again.
Thank you for that. And the translation of this shamatha in your book is tranquil abiding meditation, or calm abiding, I've heard it called as well. And that tells the story of changing your story. It's one extraordinarily important condition, is to be able to create a spaciousness that belies this absolute tendency we have to just follow off every thought, emotion, belief, all of it. There has to be a place. That's why this, to me, it's the first antidote, is a place where you can actually, as you do the out-breath, and you just rest in that for a minute, you notice, okay, we're okay right here. We're just okay.
Yeah, this is just this right here.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, and I often, you know, when I'm doing that, I often think of the words, be here now.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a life-changing book for me.
Yes, many of us. I actually was fortunate, of course, to meet him before, while he was actually writing the book. I had no idea about it, but it was all the same. All those talks at the time, they were all exactly around. You know, and you know how that happened. I mean, I can't remember. He's told it in different places, but I said, what were you doing? He was with this young man, Bhagavan Das was his name, is his name. And they were traveling through India. He had this beautiful little bus, you know, Volkswagen bus, or no, it was a Land Rover. And Bhagavan Das said, all right, I'm going to, because he had no idea, Ram Dass, about anything. He said, I'm a Buddhist. I don't want anything to do with that crazy Hindu gods and goddesses. And Bhagavan Das said, well, let me just introduce you to my guru. And they went off to do that. And on the way, Ram Dass has a lot of stories. He was regaling Bhagavan Das, all those acid trips with Leary and, you know, flying a plane on acid. I mean, it was nuts. Bhagavan Das at one point, everyone thinks this came from a be here now, the aphorism, from a spiritually, a moment of Sartori. No. Bhagavan Das said to Ram Dass when he was regaling him with these stories, for God's sake, would you just be here now? Shut up. That's how it happened. It wasn't.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I always love awesome. That. That takes the, you know, everyone's, wow, he must have spent 20 years coming up with that one. No, he was being rudely admonished, actually, is how that happened.
That's awesome.
Isn't that great? Yeah.
I'm going to remember that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're at, I could go on, and let's do this again, Lama, because there's so much here
I'd
to unpack. Everybody, don't forget, don't forget. You will have all of these links to all of these amazing different, and a link to your teacher would be great as well. So you have to sort of write in and let it, or it must be on your site, right?
A link to my teacher?
And a link to be able to people to see and maybe read his teachings.
Oh, well, yeah. So at Nonchalk, we are slowly but surely translating. Remember?
Oh, you are. Yeah, he does speak English. Yeah.
Yeah. And we have a few, we've caught him on video a few times. Not too much at this point. He's mostly teaching like very advanced students and his nuns. Right now he's in India and spends a lot of time there. He has a large monastery with nuns. And they're, I think they must be among the most well-educated and well-practiced nuns in the world in the Tibetan tradition. Really amazing.
Oh, yeah, just to be able to connect with just what the organization is doing, and him in particular, and you, of course. So
yeah,
all
and
of
then
that
his brother. Yeah, and his brother is in Montana, and he doesn't speak English either. This is a family lineage, apparently. And but he's a wonderful teacher, and he does teach shamatha, and you know, like really, the proper way, the proper Tibetan way. Shamatha leading to Vipassana. And he's quite accomplished at it and has done many long retreats and learned it from Pena Rinpoche, who was the head of the whole Nyingmapa lineage before Dingo Chensei Rinpoche was. Or no, sorry, after. And, you know, just truly a wonderful gifted teacher as well. So Namchak Ken Rinpoche, it's easier to, you know, get recordings of his teachings, and you can sign up. He's actually starting a new batch of people on beginning shamatha. So yeah, if you come to our website, you can find out the calendar of events, you know, write to us and say, I want to study shamatha with this Ken Rinpoche, and we can hook you up.
Okay, great.
And yeah, and then look for the new book that's coming out, or the previous ones in the series. The series is Ancient Wisdom for Our Times. And this third book in the series is Deepening Wisdom, Deepening Connection.
Which is, in one word, the final antidote to the me-me-ness that we are living day to day, is that connection and self-compassion, and enabling that compassion to reach out to whoever we happen to meet up with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and these practices I talk about in the book, you know, that's how you do it.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to just snap your fingers.
Yeah. Well, decades, I have that realization.
Practice.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a reason for it. Thank you so much for being here, Lama Tsomo.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, everybody, you'll be able to get linked up at the, on the show notes page on Be Here Now Network. So go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling, and you will be able to be connected with many of the books and personalities that we've been talking about. Like, we will put in Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche as a, I didn't know that your teacher was that. That's again, that's a whole other podcast, as I said. So we'll have to do that. So thank you again for being here, everybody. We'll see you next week.